The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of KKCR, its board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters.
Mahalo for supporting Kauai Community Radio, the station that loves you. We do have a phone call. We're just going to start right with it. Aloha, you're on the air.
Aloha. I wanted to share with you a link to the Hawaiian Kingdom on St. Patrick's Day. And Kamehameha III, Kaui Ke A'o'uli, chose St. Patrick's Day as his official birthday. So it was a kingdom holiday starting in about the 1830s, I think.
Okay.
Wow. His birth date was unknown, and he had a particular affinity for a few Irish peoples and knew a little bit about the patron saint of Ireland and kind of liked the leprechaun story. So it was actually a pretty big deal 150 years ago.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that.
Aloha.
Aloha. And Harry and Larry, that was a great story to start out with. Let me see if you guys are both mic'd up okay. Harry?
Yep, I'm here.
That's Harry Mavai. Okay, and Larry?
I believe I'm mic'd up.
Okay, so I got two men in the house here, and I will probably wear out that rhyme a little bit, but it's kind of fun to be saying it. And in fact, though, I like how she actually started with that, because there is a long history of getting along in Hawaii between the Kanaka and the people who they were host to for quite some time. And sometimes we only hear the rough part of the history. So that was a nice story. Today we have, this is going to definitely be a strong call-in show, but we're going to be talking about all kinds of things this first hour, everything from local to global, and everything from now to deep in history. And even Harry and I were talking about a little bit, like barking dogs. I somehow seem to be affected by that legislation, concerned about that legislation. And in the second half of the hour, we are expecting some of our permapals, our agriculture friends that got a lot of good things going on. And I believe John Cruz is going to be calling in the middle of the show. He's doing a gig in Waimea this weekend on Saturday, and so he wanted to call. We do have another caller. Aloha, you're on the air.
Hi, Felicia?
Yes.
Hi, I thought I saw posted on your Facebook page yesterday that there's a meeting at the mini golf course in Kilauea today regarding a playground planning, and I wondered if you can just touch on that quickly, and I'll get off the air.
Oh, and where's your baby boy? Is he coming in here today?
I hope so. I saw that you had that posted.
Yep. You know what? Let me look up Kauai mini golf. They're doing a really neat outreach to the community.
Yeah.
And they're going to be doing so many amazing things. It's not just at the mini golf, it's that whole Waikoa property.
Right. I know right now there's a bike path, I think, that I haven't ridden on yet, but
oh, it's beautiful. And they're going to put in a big permaculture garden area there, and another playground. They've got a lot of really nice things coming up.
I heard that somebody had mentioned something about, like, more of a natural playground. Like, when I grew up, I climbed trees and stuff, and I heard that, you know, they want to make it to where kids can be invited to climb trees or whatever it is that they want to do. They want the kids actually to participate in the planning.
Yes, that is my understanding, too, and that, you know, you can make a really, really cool playground environment out of vines as they mature and different elements of that. I'm looking up at ainaho.org, ainaho.org, and yeah, it's called a community park, and I am not seeing
thought it was at 5:30. I'd like to attend, but I'm not quite sure on the time. And I think it's today at 5:30.
5:30. I'm not seeing it right up on their Facebook page on the front side, but that would be good for people to check on and look at. And
maybe if there's a listener that knows a little bit more, they can call in and share that information.
Yeah, that would be really wonderful.
Thank you.
Okay.
Enjoy your show so far.
Yeah, I know I did put a posting up on it, but it wasn't today. So I didn't post it today, so it's been a while, and I don't quite remember. But thank you, people.
Okay.
Kilauea, New Park, community input, doing a beautiful thing there. Thank you.
I think I saw it in the Garden Isle. I think there was an article about the porters. So if anyone's got access to the Garden Isle,
okay.
If you can check it and let us know, we'll announce it.
Okay, and I will check it up right now, too. So, Larry, have you been looking at any particular things that are pretty interesting to you?
I have, but it's been from an outsider's perspective. My daughter got accepted to Penn State University, and so last week we went to Pennsylvania, and they have a big association with agriculture there. They're a land-grant university who does a lot of work in agriculture, and it was fascinating to see a university from having the experiences in Kauai to go there and to see the diversity in programs that they offer. And I actually was encouraged by it. Some of the things were pretty frightening. Some of the professors' work that they were doing was somewhat bothersome. But then they were doing a lot of work in areas that I thought were really encouraging in terms of remediating soil and utilizing biodiversification in systems to create ways to utilize science to get effective treatments for problems that exist now.
Yeah, I'm really excited to be talking about some of that today, too. There's a lot of different ways that bioremediation can happen, and I'm hoping that we can help to formulate some experiments, particularly in that Kekaha area, and get some amazing people over here and see if there's some collaborative ways to make the soil healthy and to make the community healthy and to work that out. I did look it up in the paper, and it says, if you imagine it, they will build it. And so North Shore Kids will have a new 100,000-square-foot playground to call their own by mid-October. And so people are going to be able to help build the ideal playground. And it says on Tuesday, today's Tuesday. On Tuesday, community members are invited to a free design day celebration with pupus music and a performance from Kumu Kehaulani and songs by the Kilauea Elementary School Council. So it looks like that's happening right now. So, you know, it's got a lot of really beautiful ideas here. And it's a great thing. Really, really great thing of what's going on here. And Ivory McClintock is a big part of putting this together.
The other thing about reading that, the way I interpret it, is not only do they have great ideas, but they were opening up to get the ideas of people in the community, in particular the children,
mm-hmm.
to try to create an environment that was based on the wants and needs of those who would utilize the park. And I thought that was pretty amazing opportunity.
Yeah, it says children at North Shore schools are being asked to draw and describe their dream playground today. On Tuesday, community members are invited. Yeah, and I know that that's been out, and different schools have been involved. And so this is 14 acres that Bill and Joan Porter are putting together there. And later in the day, we're going to have some folks from the permaculture class in here, and that was one of the elements. We have another caller. Aloha, you are on the air.
Aloha. I was just wondering, have you folks gotten any more information regarding the Ainaho project or the playground unveiling today?
Well, we were just talking about that.
Yes, well, in my hand, I have an official invitation.
Okay, perfect.
So I would love to just basically put out the spiel that they have on this.
Okay, do that.
Okay, well, everyone out there on Kauai, you are invited to the magical, the mysterious, and the totally awesome playground unveiling. That is today, Tuesday, March 11th, from 5 to 7 p.m.
Okay.
And that is at the Kauai Mini Golf. They will have poo-poos, music, the unveiling, and choke fun for everybody. So if anybody else would like to get involved or also help with this project, they have put out that you can contact a person by the name of Ivory McClintock, speaking of the Irish, at ivory@inaho.org.
So that's A-N-A-I-N-A-H-O-U.org.
And Ivory is an I-V-O-R-Y.
Perfect.
And if I'm reading on the backside here, they're also putting out, you know, that you can join in this Ohana concept. They have raised so far, I believe, up to $175,000, and they have a goal of $250,000. So if anybody else is out there willing to participate with donations or anything to put, this would be the time and the place. Come and join them. And as always, we'd like to put out a big mahalo to Bill and Joan Porter and Bill and Karen Clifford and everybody on Kauai that's participating in this project.
Wonderful.
So there you go.
Okay. Thank you, Akamai listener.
As well. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Ahui-ho.
Ahui-ho.
Since we're going to be on the air and we may be late, can you make sure that any of the amenities are large enough to support large children like us who embrace immaturity? That the vines are strong enough to hold us if we swing on them?
Oh, that's right. Though we better go and make sure that they can.
Well, what I know, when we did the Kamalani Playground, we kind of started doing the same thing for the kids. They came in and helped.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. I was part of the bridge project. I didn't get to do the one right in the full lid gate, flat part of the park.
Oh, yeah. I got to do the ceramics with the snake and everything with the kids. That was fun.
Yeah, a lot of fun. And you can make something really, really nice. And I think the whole area around there is going to be very beautiful. So anybody listening, go on and go there. So I asked Harry to come in, and I asked him, what did you do today? And he said he was sitting there watching tennis all day.
Love tennis.
Love tennis. Yep. And so you used to play it?
Not as often as I wanted to, but I played it before.
Mm-hmm.
It's the whole match of trying to beat the other guy.
Mm-hmm. And you live in Anahola.
I live in Anahola.
Yep. So, guys, I had posted something out on Facebook that I found quite interesting, just more pieces of history. I just want to bring that up a little bit. Did you get a chance to look at it, Larry?
Which piece?
You post a
lot.
I know, I post a lot. It is on some history of the United States with these giants, right? These very, very big people, sometimes with double layers of teeth. And, you know, I've heard something about that somewhat, and I definitely know because my sister was at University of Idaho in Pocatello, and they have a big, museum where they have not only just woolly mammoths and saber-toothed tigers, but you saw that, like, all these mammals and animals, rats, everything, were just monster-sized. So it makes sense that people were big. But what I found interesting in that is that there is really thousands of these skeletons that had been found and documented in things like the New York Times, and documented pretty much since people first came over from Europe and were starting to settle there and finding them and saying they, you know, there's all these very, very large Indians is what they called them, you know, and the stone houses and the mound builders. And I've been in areas where the mound builders are. But only once your mind starts getting opened, or at least for me this is the case, once my mind starts getting opened to alternative histories, that I even begin to actually accept those things as real and not something that maybe that you'd see on the cover of the National Enquirer. And so I bothered, after I watched that, to Google search some of the comments that they made. Like, I did already know that one of the reasons that Thomas Jefferson sent Lewis and Clark out west to be looking was because in the Deep South, they were finding these big woolly mammoth heads, and the slaves from Africa were recognizing them and trying to tell them what elephants were. But they weren't quite elephants, and they were finding all these different things, and so Jefferson sent some of that going and looking for what had created this pieces of history. We don't learn that when we learn history. We don't say they were going and looking for all these incredible big creatures. And then also I looked up like Abraham Lincoln being quoted as referencing, I don't have the quote right in front of me, but referencing the monster people, the very big people who used to live here with the double rows of teeth. And then so when you see how much that actually used to be common awareness and people would find these places and how that doesn't make it in our school books, you know, how much doesn't make it in this past year or two, I keep finding more and more stuff was in South America, Africa, especially in the south of Africa, all over. There's an incredible amount of evidence that there was strong civilization here probably before the last ice age. And why does that not make it in the school books?
I don't know specifically in regards to that, but I do know that a lot of things in textbooks is repeated history. So something gets quoted hundreds of years ago and repetitively gets quoted and referenced, and it takes a special person, and I think it takes a special mind thought process to go outside of the box and be able to start talking about something that contradicts mainstream views. So I'm not entirely surprised by that. If there was a historically through time, there's always been battles between science and religion, and sometimes views would fulfill one need of whoever was the ruling power at the time. And I just think it takes a lot of courage to step outside the box and say, I believe this to be true, which is contrary to the popular belief. The people who say that face a lot of adversity. And so I'm not surprised when things aren't translated from generation to generation that as it maybe should be.
Generations. That's the whole thing. Our history goes back a ways, and it's hard to say what they want to teach us.
Well, it seems like omitting the dinosaurs, you know, like it's a very big piece, and that once I started to look, there's actually a lot of history. It was kind of common knowledge 150 years ago.
To certain groups.
Well, I mean, if it's in the New York Times, if the president's talking about it, it seems like that's more than just a certain group.
What if the ruling party was more creation and not evolution? And when I looked at those skulls of what you're referring to, they're somewhere in between what man looks like today and apes. And maybe they're human. Maybe they're more that they're not human, but maybe it's part of the continuum of evolution. And maybe that was frowned upon at that time, because things like that. I don't know the date of those skulls, but in geologic time versus historical times. They may be relatively recent, but that could be those skulls may, I don't know the date, but they could be millions of years old. Do you know the dates on those skulls that they were speaking?
Well, they're you know, thinking thousands of years old. They could be some, you know, like when the mammoths and those things were there, you know, that was at least 10,000 years ago. It was before the last ice age. But these aren't primitive. They have highly evolved tools. They're found with metal adornments on them, you know, they're clothed. They aren't apes.
But primitive technology, primitive,
it's not primitive.
But primitive versus advanced may be a relative thing, because if there's a cataclysmic event, environmental event, if Yellowstone volcano blows and man gets wiped out, there you start the process over again. So when you're speaking about advanced technology versus primitive, it could be a relative phenomenon. There may have been very advanced cultures present here prior to the Ice Age that could do things far better. But if there was a period or an event that caused an extinction, and then you started with a very small population and grew it, you wouldn't start advanced. You would have to start over again. And I don't value it. When I say primitive, you could have advanced cultures that existed a million years ago, and there could have been a cataclysmic event which caused an ice age or a flooding of areas, because a lot of the areas that were in the middle of the United States were underwater. They were underseas. Things can change dramatically, but they could be very advanced from eons ago.
Well, I realize that, but when I see that 150 years ago, 200 years ago, 250, 300 years ago, there was routine writing about this, and this was dialogue that went even from those in power in the colonies over to England, the King of England, and things like that, you think, well, it's not like if we had an extinction event and it started over, fine. But we should be teaching, well, there's probably been a lot of stuff going on before. Then there was an extinction event. Then we started over. And so then you just put it in that context rather than denying that these things ever happened. That's, I think, you know, as an educator, something that I go through when I'm teaching alternative paths, and we're mostly teaching nature-based learning and what the kids seem to be interested in, and sometimes I'll feel a certain amount of angst or concern if they're not getting the same things that they would be getting in school. But the more I learn and the more I read, I think, well, you know what? Not that anybody at school is intentionally not teaching the kids the right thing, but somehow, collectively, when they put these educational books together, they decided, well, they, and that might have been 100 years ago, this is what we want people to be aware of. Instead of, you know, there's a conscious omission to be having something that was so well known in the past to simply not be known now. And, you know, we get ridiculed for you know, questioning the dominant story.
Yeah, I think that's the problem. I don't think there's anything that prohibits one from giving an alternative viewpoint. It's just hard to live with the consequences of that. It takes courage to do that. I think that's throughout society and cultures. It takes courage to go against mainstream thought with conviction and with facts to prove something that's universally accepted.
Well, it's even like what I have learned since being a programmer and listening to people speak about Hawaii's history, where I just didn't question it very deeply. Then in trying to research it, I kind of go, wow, you know what? They're right. And they, meaning the people who say that it wasn't a legitimate changeover. And people get really ridiculed for saying that. And it's challenging.
Well, for me, when growing up, I went to school in the mainland. History. World history.
But you are Hawaiian, yes?
Yeah. They never really taught anything about the Hawaiian history. There was nothing of that sort in my school. I grew up in a predominantly white America in Washington, pretty much what it was. And like I said, the history I was taught was the USA history, Washington State history, world problems history. And that's what I grew up as knowing. Until I came home, my history was in my face. You know, whoa, where was this in the books? All I was told, James Cook conquered or
discovered
Hawaii. Whoa, that's what I learned.
What if you said to those professors, James Cook didn't discover Hawaii, but came here and tried to sequester Hawaii and brought things to the culture that weren't necessarily good for them? What would happen in that discussion? Would that be encouraged in the school, or would you be discouraged?
I would be, and it's hard to say what James Cook came here for. As far as the history that we had here before that, you know, we were doing what we were surviving,
mm-hmm.
living on the land. That's what our people did. Everything that was brought to them was here.
My understanding of why James Cook came, in case you don't know this, Larry, is that was during the American Revolution. And so he was sent from the British government to find a way around behind the colonists. They did not realize how large North America was. And so they went around the South American point, came up and around, and they were looking to get back there. And Captain Cook never made it back. So he came through Hawaii a couple times. They went out further. They came back and died. George Vancouver, his first mate, made it to Washington and the Pacific Northwest, but he still couldn't get across, so he came back. But so Captain Cook didn't come here to, he didn't expect to find Hawaii. He was coming simply looking on a military mission to find the back route to the United States.
But Hawaii didn't need to be discovered. It was present and viable and functional with or without Captain Cook.
Oh, yeah. Yes, of course. Yeah. Do we have a caller?
You do, and it's a call I think you want to take. It's John Cruz.
Hey.
Hi, John.
Hi, Felicia.
How are you?
Could be better. My internet is down. My phone is down. I'm using a friend's phone.
And I have to say, you are listening to KKCR Hanalei KAQA Kilauea.
Yes.
All right, John. So what's on your mind?
A lot of things are on my mind, but main thing is a benefit this weekend that I'm doing for the Kauai Veterans Memorial Hospital.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good thing.
At the Waimea Theater.
And what time does it start?
7:30.
I have my tickets.
Yeah. Right on. I got my tickets. I got my ticket to fly up there, yeah.
You've got your ticket to fly up there. And so are you just coming for that day and leaving the next day? Are you doing other gigs?
I'm coming that day and probably staying for 2 or 3 days.
Right on. So I know usually when you're here, you're typically going around and helping and meeting other folks. And
Trying to do whatever I can, you know.
Yep. So I know that at the hospital, they're trying to get some perinatal beds and just bring up, I think their real goal is, Larry, do you remember their real goal, their financial goal at the hospital on the other side is?
I think it was about $25,000, $30,000 to buy some special need beds.
Yeah.
Well, that's probably what they'll get out of this, and then they really need a couple few $100s. So if there's any angel donors out there, I think if you want to donate to KVMH, you can do that, too. So do you have a new album coming out? You said
Yes, I do. I'm in the mixing stages. Believe it or not, I've been mixing the songs. And I haven't been stressing about it. You know, like, oh, my God, I got to mix the album. I got to finish the album. Just because I'm stressing about other things. I just moved into a new place. My car broke down. It goes on and on. But anyway.
I'm not stressing
about the album. I'm just, you know, just trying to play the music, and I hopefully, you know, hopefully it'll come out how it wants to.
I'm sure it will be an excellent show. Is there anybody warming up for you?
A band made up of doctors from the hospital. They're playing with them. They're also playing.
Oh, right on.
And yeah, we're going to do some jamming together. It'll be interesting. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
And Sean Carrillo is playing?
Sean might be playing with me also, yes. Yes.
Yeah, and then
if we have another Carrillo that's around, you know, that we could track down on the island, that would be wonderful.
As in Frank? You
know? As in Frank, yes, of course.
Yes.
How's the weather up there? Is it beautiful now? Is it sun out?
It's beautiful.
It's been raining for a few days, right?
It's beautiful.
Right, yeah. I haven't been to Kauai in a while, so I'm really looking forward to coming up there and experiencing the island.
Yes. Well, we're happy that you're going to do
Thank
that.
Thank you for all you do for the islands and for the islands, for the islands. Felicia.
Well, thank you. And I think the last time you were here might have been the Homegrown Festival. So you're here pretty regularly, almost always blessing us one way or another. So,
yep, and the island is blessing us all, really. Yeah. The island is blessing us all.
Okay, so that's Saturday, March 15th. 7:30.
March
7:30. At the Waimea
Theater.
Tickets are around. I know Kauai Music and Sound in Kapa'a, and I think Scotty's Music. I don't have it right in front of me. Do you?
No, I don't.
Okay, I'll try and look it up.
Get it in front of me right now.
Okay, you're looking it up right now?
Yeah, I'm looking it up right now.
Okay, should I torture you and make you sing a song while we're waiting?
Sure.
Okay, sing something.
Sure. Okay. We'll sing this. All I need is a little air. Some for me, some for everywhere. All I need is a little sun. Some for me, some for everyone. A little bit of love. All it takes.
Right on. Very good. You're always good right on the spot there, so... Perfect. That was really nice.
Thank you. Well, I guess I'll see you this weekend.
Yep.
Hopefully we'll see a bunch of people there.
Yeah, a bunch of people. And it's a great auditorium. Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. It is a good show.
That's right on. Mr. Cruz.
Mr. Cruz, yes. He's helped us with a lot of different things over here. So I want to talk about barking dogs for a moment. I have a real problem with that ordinance. Partly, I'll be honest, because I have a dog, right? I have two dogs. And
barking
dogs. Sometimes they bark. We got another caller. We might take that call right now, but... we'll take the call, but then we'll talk about barking dogs. Aloha, you're on the air.
Woof, woof.
Woof, woof.
I got a couple woofs to contribute.
Okay.
When Captain Cook came here, he became aware of the benefits of the breadfruit. And as I understand it, he got the idea, therefore, of saying, well, we could feed the slaves. That means the black folk. In the Caribbean, on all the plantations the British had. So I think they tried to transport the breadfruit on some British vessels to the Caribbean. I don't know if they succeeded in doing so. And then the second comment I wanted to make was that it seems that we should encourage the great philanthropists like Mr. Steve Case, who I saw on 60 Minutes, along with all these other billionaires, and they were talking about their great contributions. So I would, you know, the worst thing they could say is, like, forget about it. But I would say, you know, it doesn't hurt to ask that maybe he could be an angel donor to some of these causes. And then, of course, I've always wanted to ask him, well, since you're giving all this money away and doing all this good, why did you lease the land to the GMO folk? Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Actually, you know, I think the short answer on that, even though it's not really up to me to give that answer, I think when that industry was first suggesting coming over, it was corn seeds. And biotech was in its infancy. And I don't think anybody understood it. And I know at the time, I've said this many times on air, I was at a lot of those meetings as a person from the North Shore Business Council who happened to be there when they were talking to the West Side Development Center, Development Corporation, and it never, ever was described that this was going to be a technology that was, you know, possibly very unhealthy or that would be requiring a lot of pesticides. Everything was all a very, very positive thing. And I remember, I've said this before, but feeling almost jealous that they're getting this great opportunity to diversify their economy, and it seemed like it didn't have a downside. And unless you learn to look deeply, you don't find it. And I have, at that time, I was somebody very much like you were talking, Harry, about being educated along the mainstream thought process, and you believe what you're being taught in school. You believe it, and certainly I'm sure that the teachers believe it when they're doing it, and probably even the superintendent of schools believes it. And we don't learn things like about how the Federal Reserve System was set up or where there were these different things that was difficult. And even now, people who go to college that's funded by, you know, this new high-technology agriculture, they're trained in college to learn this is good and this is essential and this is the right thing. So you have to be somewhat of a rebel to question it. And it's tough because when you come from a position of trust, that feels good, and it's rough to have to change that.
I think that when you're in a environment of, for lack of a better word, intellectual honesty and academics, that you can, you don't have, it's a choice the direction you go. I think that most institutions that try to teach learning and take their job seriously encourage diversification of thought. If you go to law school, it doesn't mean that you become a bad lawyer, but you can go to law school and become a bad lawyer, or you could become a good lawyer. You could take any technology or any educational venue, and you could choose to use it in a way that's not very good, or it's not intellectually honest. Or you can use it and use your intellectual curiosity to develop pathways that are beneficial. I think those are choices. And when we're talking about condemning something retrospectively, like how did these guys end up with this land, it's not a bad concept. It's not a bad concept to try to create something that's better, to use it as a mechanism to try to make things better. It's where it gets bad is if it's not good or it's detrimental, that viewing the opposing viewpoint becomes problematic. And it gets lost down the path of you can't challenge an accepted viewpoint. And that's the silliness of, the educational process, where you can condemn learning, and learning's not the problem. Advancement's not the problem. It's the choices you make during that path.
Yes, and when you taught surgery, right? That's mm-hmm. what you used to be professor yeah. of, teaching people how to be surgeons. Did you ever contemplate alternatives like Rolfing or something like that ahead of surgery? I mean, did you teach? A lot of times people who are in med school are taught one way to take care of patients, which is allopathic medicine. Did you encourage the exploration of naturopathic medicine?
I did. I'm 50. I'll be 58 next birthday. And when I started my teaching at University of Arizona, I would send patients to Andy Weil,
I don't know who that is.
He's one of the pioneers of holistic medicine. And I would use cranial sacral therapists and chiropractors. And I didn't care how people got better. And I thought the better academic perspective was to have a broad visual field versus a narrow focus. And one of the things that happens in a lot of societies is whatever is in our visual field becomes the accepted perspective, and looking outside the visual field is a little bit more difficult. Did I take some heat for that? Yeah. Did I get some raised eyebrows from that? Yeah. But looking back on trying to find a treatment that wasn't within my teaching to try to make someone better, I thought that was the way to do it. Now, a lot of people went off the path and to make money, they would utilize their training as justification to make money. But those are personal choices. And I get into trouble because I enjoy discussing various alternatives and opinions that are contrary to mainstream thinking. But that's not an easy thing to do. A lot of people look at you a little bit funny, like, how dare you say that to me?
Well, I think you're right there with choices. People make their choices to go where they want to go.
Right.
You know, and that's about what we got to do here for our GMO that's on the island. We have to make a choice and which way to go.
And if one of the possibilities was that it could be a wonderful technology with low risk, that would be a nice choice. But right now, this is my opinion. I don't believe that's the current form of the industry. So I would like to see them at least be open enough to be to honestly assess what they're doing to say, is it okay or do we need to make it better?
And I think they need to open up a little bit more, because the fact is the people here on the island we already got a lot of mistrust for the GMO, and they got to open up just to give us what they have.
Earned mistrust.
Exactly.
They earned that mistrust.
Let us know what you have.
You're right.
You know?
But I think it's choices. The caller was
choices.
Talking about how did they end up giving the land to the people, because the perception, I believe, the people in the room at the beginning probably thought, here's something that's going to be beneficial. But when it got off track and it wasn't beneficial and there was a potential detriment, then when you would raise that as an issue, you'd get squashed. You get ridiculed. It became awkward for people to say, I'm scared, I'm worried, I'm concerned, can I have more understanding? That's wrong.
That's the hardest thing, is fear. People's opinion. And a lot of fear to even express your opinion on something or anything.
But if I'm a wise person, I should respect your opinion. I may not agree with it, and you and I could talk, but shouldn't we be able to talk, disagree, and be able to respect each
Confront
other's
each
opinion?
Other. Come and, up with it.
And it's kind of analogous to, we're probably about the same age. You go back to the old days, you could have a tussle.
Because, you know, that's what we have to do. Talk.
Yeah, and talk. Hey, and I realized one thing that I rerouted my conversation on the call. And you are listening to KKCR Hanalei KAQA Kilauea. I have Harry Mavai and Larry Schneider in here. And I wanted to actually talk about dogs for a moment. That seems like such a small issue, but to me it's a very it's a big issue, because
she's
looking
at us.
Well, when I see this thing, like, you know, if your dog barks for 10 minutes, that your neighbor can call and turn you in, and then you get some little choices like, okay, 10 days, solve the problem, and then if you don't solve it in 10 days, you know, it's like, to me, a 10-minute bark isn't a very long bark. It could be any time in the day, and I think dogs serve a purpose here. They help bring food, hunting. They do protection and security.
You have hunting dogs in the neighborhood. You have people that has dogs without a leash. Those dogs are creating a havoc for the dogs that are in the pen.
Yeah.
And they're barking all day. You know, so I say control the dogs that are without a leash. Get rid of those dogs. The hunting dogs, now I know the hunters, they take care of their dogs. You know, I've seen them feed their own dogs their pills, do whatever. But it's not the hunting dogs, it's the loose dogs without a leash.
Well,
put them on a leash.
But even like somebody walks with a leash by your house, like I know, like I live right near the park. Supposedly there's no animals in the park, but people bring their dogs all the time in the park. So then the dogs come up to the fence, the dogs bark. You know, it starts to create an environment of intolerance. I would like to see something like two neighbors have to complain, and it has to be two or three little incidences where it's a problem. Because I feel like if you've got a pack of hunting dogs around the corner, I say, you know, go talk to that person with the hunting dogs and say, make it worth my while. I want to get some food out of you. You know what I mean? Like, because I think that, like, when we stop having hunting dogs, or even when we're not allowed to have dogs, because that's essentially what this law is. It's saying you can have a house dog, but you can't have an outside dog with a neighbor who doesn't like you. You know, it really empowers a neighbor to create an issue. Well, what if something happens to us and those hunting dogs are gone? We need those dogs.
Keep your dog on a leash. In your yard.
Yeah.
Fenced in.
But you can fence them in and they're still going to bark. Okay, I got to call
it. Exactly.
Aloha, you're on the air.
Is that me?
Yes, it is.
Okay, great. You know, thank you so much once again for talking about this topic because it kind of hits me here at home. You know, I've got a great little spread down here in Mullawa Farm. And, you know, most, I would say predominantly, you know, our diet and everything that we deal with is pretty much vegetarian. You know, we try to grow our own food and things of this nature. And through the course of it, though, you know, we have a couple of dogs, you know, that patrol specifically our 5 acres of Ina, mainly to keep away either the chickens or, you know, in the course of things, usually pigs. Now, the only time the pigs usually come out of the hills and down in valley, you know, they do come at different times, you know, during the month, but they're pretty regular unless something disrupts their cycle. And when the pigs do come down, you know, my dogs pretty much get a little bit vocal, and they're just kind of trying to let me know, you know, that we've got somebody on the property, and they're trying to protect basically our livelihood, you know, in terms of food that we plant and try to grow, and I keep them at bay. Now, I'm not one of those that gets aggressive to go out with a knife, a bow, or a gun, you know, to pursue these animals, you know, and at the same time, I would like to keep them at bay. You know, so, I mean, the only time my dogs really ever bark, once again, is if they're alerting us, that is the family, you know, that there is an intruder of any nature. The only three types that they've ever really gone after, you know, once again, the pigs predominantly, but we know their cycle. Sometimes they can be on, you know, quite vocal, you know, just to let us know, because some of the pigs and some of the confrontations that my dogs have had with the pigs, unfortunately, has cost me a tremendous amount when I take it to the vet. You know, they've been sliced up, you know, tore up, and I've got two, you know, and they usually can handle their own. But every now and then, you know, we get one, you know, one pretty aggressive boar, you know, that comes down and does, you know, does a number on them. You know, but the damage that these pigs do is far greater, you know, than our dogs barking. And yet the neighbors still sometimes have issues with, you know, us and our dogs and them barking, and I try to tell them, hey, they're just alerting us, and I can tell myself if I'm on the land, you know, what they're barking at, cat, human, or pig. And a lot of times, too, it's even the neighbor who's milling out in the middle of their yard sometimes between 10 and 12 o'clock in the morning, you know, kind of doing that, and they're just alerting me, hey, there's somebody next door that's walking about. Yes, we've also had, you know, certain people that do not respect our spaces here in the valley. That is meaning, you know, they're coming to check out, scope, you know, to see whether there's anybody home or whether they can help themselves, you know, to anything that may be around. You know, we have those issues as well, too. You know, so I'm thoroughly aware of this, but I'm just trying to find a complacent way. Can I do that without being penalized, you know, for having my animals when I don't want to necessarily be overly aggressive by hunting the pigs out, you know, and just trying to keep them at bay? So I'm just kind of projecting that forward to you folks. If you'd like to talk about this topic, you know, and how it can help us, we'd greatly appreciate anybody's manawa on this. And once again, you know, to help my neighbors as well, too, to find an amicable place and space that they can be accepting of this. We'd appreciate it and would love to, you know, hear your answer off the phone.
Okay.
Or off the air.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
So he brought up amicable. I mean, I know barking dogs are annoying. I bring my dogs in at night, and I, you know, put them in the bunny pen when I leave. So, but they're still going to, if something's right behind them, they're going to bark a little bit right there. I think it's important to be calling your neighbor. And if you call your neighbor and say, hey, your dog's bothering me, I think that's a better first step than essentially calling the police or calling, you know, creating a problem. I think sometimes we can have so many rules that, you know, life hardly seems normal. I feel the same way about chipping cats. And my cats, unfortunately, are chipped. All my animals are chipped. But I feel like we're next. Do you talk to your neighbors who have the barking dogs?
Oh, yeah. I do. But what can you do? They just go on barking. My dog barks. I know when he's tangled up. I know when he wants to check out the dog next door.
Right.
You know their barks, like this guy was saying. He knows the bark, you know, and what can you do? The dog's going to bark, you know, he's trying to protect their home, you know.
Right.
It's a hard thing to say.
And for how many thousands of years have people and dogs partnered for a reason like that? I mean, the Kanakas brought the dogs over with them, right? They brought dogs, right? From Polynesia.
Polynesia.
It's like a central animal and has been in a lot of other areas. But I guess that's enough on dogs. Larry, I noticed a couple people called and they asked you things. Were they talking about dogs?
One caller wanted to speak, but then she must have hung up. The other call was not about what we were discussing.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, if you do want to call in, 826-7771. And Harry and I make poi together.
Love poi
at YFA. And, you know, getting along in the neighborhood, I think, is a really important element. You live in the homesteads, Hawaiian homesteads?
Hawaiian homesteads.
Anahola.
The illegal land.
The illegal land? Yeah?
I'm living illegally.
Is that right?
Of course. Hawaiian homelands. Hawaiian. It's not legal.
What do you mean?
Okay.
I must be missing. You mean Hawaiian shouldn't? It's not a legal country. Okay. Yes. All right. I got that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, how do you feel about the power installation in Anahola? We've had a lot of dialogue on that.
Well, do we get to keep the power in Anahola?
I don't think so.
I don't think so. Then it shouldn't be there. That's the way I feel.
Yeah, I mean, what I see pretty consistently is Hawaiian homelands are utilized pretty much just like public lands, like for general infrastructure. And did you have to be on the list for very long, or did you have an easy time getting your place?
Well, what it was is my mom's name on the list. That's why I got the property.
Oh, that's good.
But how they would call it the dying list. He finally got on the list, too.
Your son?
Yeah.
He's on the list.
A dying list, he calls it.
Right on. Are all your children on the list?
No. Now my last two is. The other two isn't. But I don't know.
Yeah.
Hawaiian homes.
Hawaiian homes. So we're hoping to get more homes for Hawaiians.
Well, there's some coming up.
Where are they coming up?
Anahola.
There are some more houses coming up in Anahola?
Yeah.
Are they slated for pretty soon?
I'm not sure. I think next year.
Oh, that's pretty soon.
But.
Yeah. Well, that's definitely a good thing. So, also, when I was speaking about some of this history things, it seems like in current events, too, it's pretty selective of what things go on in current events. I know, Larry, that you had mentioned that you had a few items for the show today.
Oh. Not specifically, but just conceptually about... We've touched on them. They all involve choice and information delivery and things like that. So you're catching me a little bit off guard because I didn't think of anything specifically to discuss much as...
I wanted to make sure I wasn't cutting you off on that.
No, you aren't. I just in a egocentric perspective, it's easy to talk about the experience of going... to, you know, the experience with my daughter going to a university, which is that was interesting. It was
that
interesting.
What's interesting is that it is supported by this industry. Is that the piece?
Some aspects of it are, and so it could be perceived as being supported. And that was a concern, taking my daughter to a place that wanted to go to school there, would there be potential to come out of that with freedom of choice, or would it be guided? Because a lot of people have a lot of strong opinions about that. I heard repeatedly before, why would you want to have her educated at a place like that?
And when you say a place like that, you mean a place that Monsanto specifically underwrites that school?
Or the industry as a whole, the biotech industry that we deal with.
Well, that's most of the agricultural colleges.
Yeah, correct.
I think that there's very few schools that actually have an independent agriculture department. It's almost like no longer the norm. And as I say, 90% of the corn is this biotech corn. It's hard to find an agricultural college that isn't influenced deeply by the industry.
And people are shocked by that number. When you start talking to people, even in that town, they were shocked. When you start to discuss what was going on and what was happening in Kauai in terms of experimentation fields and why some of the experiments were being done, most people are unaware. And that's an interesting phenomena, that things can get passed through and they become commonplace without a level of awareness. And I could see Harry's face when he's talking about, when you're asking about the solar in Anahola, there's this, I may be misinterpreting, but a look of, it's supposed to be for this, but it's not gonna be a benefit to us. And that's not an uncommon phenomenon where things happen at a big scale. And the individuals that are affected are not affected in a positive way. It's to benefit others.
We've benefited everybody already. Give us something back. You know?
Yeah.
That's all.
That's a reasonable perspective. If you're going to use a property for me, should I not see some benefit?
Exactly.
From it. Do I have to see all the risk and no benefit? That's a reasonable question to ask anybody in a normal conversation. It's just hard to have that with a corporate conversation.
Our land's been given away so easily. It's unreal. We can't even touch any of it back to us. I mean, it's a system that's been created here over 170 years ago, and those systems are still here in the state of Hawaii. Conglomerate, whatever, properties.
A lot of indigenous populations get overtaken by outsiders that come in.
Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts? Because obviously living in Anahola and being Hawaiian, it's personal and specific. But it's pretty commonplace in history. I'm first generation American, and the lands that my ancestors had were taken, and not in a pleasant way. It was taken very unpleasantly, and those who opposed were killed.
That's Germany,
living in
the wrong neighborhood. Yeah. And you're listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, K284AL Haleiwa.
So it's really interesting to have Harry sitting here. How does that feel? How does it feel to you as an individual to see that happen?
Well, in my perspective with the lands, I'm past the age where I can almost do something, but it's now to the next generation and the next generation. They have to fulfill that time now. My time's up. I'm just telling the next generation to get on the wagon and jump on it, you know, because time is spent already.
What wisdom do you give the future generations?
You have to sit down and, you know, get that land back. Our young people are getting educated. That's the first fact, you know. And they're starting to come out of the works. So go get them.
Yes, and we have Harry Mavai from Anahola, Larry Schneider from Kilauea, and who is joining us is Peter Pilarski, over here from Montana, and this is Kauai Soapbox Live, which is made possible by listeners like you in partnership with Bali High Realty, Anahola Stringed Instruments, Aya's Garden, and El Pastor Tacos.
Coldwell Banker, Bali High Realty, and Hanalei, serving Kauai since 1978, providing personalized real estate sales and rental services. Coldwell Banker, Bali High Realty, also supports KKCR and the Kauai Independent Food Bank. More information at balihigh.com or by calling 826-7244.
Anahola Stringed Instruments is proud to support KKCR. Mickey Sussman has been building Island Koa guitars, ukulele, and violins on Kauai since 1972. Time-honored designs and special orders. Prompt and complete restoration, repair, and reforestation. AnaholaStringedInstruments.com or 822-1645.
Aya's Garden, all-natural garden and greenhouse supply. In Kapa'a, down Kukui Street from the Dragon Building. Fertilizers, amendments, soil, seeds, garden and farm organic growing supplies. Open Monday through Saturday. More information at 822-7333 or visit Aya's Garden on Facebook.
El Pastor Tacos supports KKCR, across the street from the craft fair in Kapa'a by the beach. El Pastor Tacos serves fresh grilled local fish, steak, chicken, and pork tacos, and burritos in the El Pastor style. Also a garden salad and choices for the kids. Open every day from 11 to 4. Takeout orders welcome. El Pastor Tacos, authentic Mexican food. 652-6953.
And mahalo for supporting Kauai Community Radio, the station that loves you. We do have a caller. Aloha, you're on the air.
Aloha. I was listening to your conversation there about the frustrations of losing our national lands and what can, you know, what can we do about that? Yeah.
Yes.
Hello?
Uh-huh. You're right. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Am I on the right track? Is that what I heard?
You did.
Okay. So I hear some frustration out there about that. And so I would like to inform everybody that since March 13, 1999, the Hawaiian government has been reinstated. And losing our land, we can get back the lands that were lost to this Hawaiian government through their legislature, which can reclaim the lands. So if all you got to do is support the Hawaiian government, participate, you know, and running for office and voting, you know, we need nationals to vote. And you can begin to reacquire and reclaim your lands to a Hawaiian government. Hello?
Yes, I'm letting you finish. It's it's an important point.
Yes, yes. And so that's the road I see that we can legally, lawfully regain our country. And I think with the license plates, you're going to see that the state has been recognizing the process that put out those license plates. It was a legislative process. It wasn't just anybody just putting on those license plates. And so...
Is this for the Kingdom of Atui?
No.
Reinstated Hawaiian?
Reinstated. Reinstated Hawaiian government, the yellow plate.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's evidence of some of our successes.
Yes.
Yeah, because the state of Hawaii does not want to give up power, so they're resisting giving us recognition. But when we go to a higher court, I think the playing field will be leveled out and that we will be recognized, you know, by the rest of the world.
Well, I think that a lot of really impressive progress has been made, and I know that many countries around the world that were occupied have been getting their freedom, some places after 300, 400, or 500 years.
Well, the Arab Spring, I believe, is evidence of that. And I think, you know, we should spotlight Hawaiian sovereignty more intensely. For instance, we don't have a treaty. And so I question, how can the rest of the laws follow with no treaty? You know, you're asking for chaos to happen because there's no anchor for that foreign constitution to be here in Hawaii. We have no treaty with them. So I think when more people understand that, they can use Hawaiian law. You can now choose which laws to follow.
Well, I do think that more and more people are becoming aware, and I just give myself as that example. You know, 5 years ago, I'm sorry to say it, but I didn't even really think about it very much. And, you know, I have become quite aware, as we've seen these other elements like the Public Land Development Corporation or the Agribusiness Development Corporation, seeing where those are injustices that happen in the very recent past, then you start to go, oh, I get it, you know, and then looking a little bit deeper and seeing how we have a chronic condition of doing that, though occupation is a pretty powerful element.
GMOs being in the forefront there and Hawaiian homes being on the front pages, people understand that there is a big question mark on land ownership here in Hawaii. And, you know, coming from the homestead, which is supposed to be representing a Hawaiian nation, which they aren't. In fact, they practice genocide. When you start doing 50% blood quantum, that's a recipe for genocide. And Hawaiian homes is unconstitutional with their own constitution.
Yes.
It says that you can't put one race above the other, but only in Hawaii does that happen.
Well, we should work to have a couple of shows that really explore this well. I had a caller who called in wanting to know, and it's a little bit long for this particular show, but because it really have to do justice to it, there's a number of different sovereignty movements that are claiming their position, and it's...
No, I disagree with what you just said there, Felicia. You know, a sovereignty group, you call yourself a sovereignty group, you have to have elections. I mean, a public election.
Okay, so...
Not in-house elections.
Thank you for the correction.
Yes.
So,
and there's only one entity I know that has those qualifications. That's the reinstated.
The reinstated, and then
yes, they have four election cycles already.
I know.
I've seen them happening.
History. And then,
and then the making of the laws has weight. And now they're supporting the burial council. How's that? In this occupied country, they won't even let us bury our dead. You try to go on the mainland and dig up a cemetery over there. You have a revolution on your hands. Why aren't the Hawaiian people up in arms? Had enough with the state. They are corrupt and illegal. And we don't have to listen to their laws. Listen to Hawaiian laws. Mo better.
Well, thank you. Would you like to come in and do a show sometime?
I would love to.
Okay, because this is such an important topic, and I need help doing justice to it. So when I'm quiet, it's because I recognize it's not my kuleana to even really have an opinion.
You know, the Kanaka people have an obligation to restore their nation. It's an obligation, and that's a Kanaka. That's what a Kanaka is, a citizen in the Hawaiian nation.
Okay,
Felicia.
Do you know how to get a hold of me?
Yes, yes.
Okay, get a hold of me.
Real soon.
Okay.
Aloha.
Aloha. Okay, and caller? And we've got a guest in here, too, but you're on the air right now.
Hi. I came on the radio before, and I've been to the newspaper, and I've been to county council meetings about chimney smoke.
Yes. And did you have a child who is badly affected by it?
Yes, I do.
Yes. How's your baby doing?
Well, we were doing very good for a while, but then we have these neighbors that spend half the year here and half the year in the mainland. And as soon as they came back, they fired up their chimney, which is three houses down from me,
mm-hmm.
and we immediately took a dive.
I'm sorry.
And so finally, after about the final straw, when I saw the horrifying look in my child's face that I saw at Kapi'olani Hospital on his hospital bed, once I could see the signs that he was heading in that direction again, I went again to go and address my neighbor.
Yes.
And see if we could get some type of relief. And out of desperation, you know, I told him that I could help you. I'll buy your chimney. I'll pay for your propane and stuff. And so, and we were kind of trying to agree on that. So he came back a couple days later with a letter for $1,600 for a chimney and stuff. And then I'm a really moral person. I don't lie, cheat, steal. I wear my seatbelt and, you know, I do everything against according to the law because I'm a father.
Uh-huh.
And I want to create a good.
So what happened?
So now I'm basically at the mercy of $1,600 to pay my neighbor off for my freedom of fresh air. And I've been through the state, I've been through the county, I've been through every single person that you can look up legally for help on this situation, and they've left me nothing but for me to die in my house with somebody else on their private residence and sending their smoke towards my house and making my three-year-old smoke.
So,
and all of us smoke.
I am sorry about that. So, and I don't mean to be hurrying you. I have a guest and I have a couple other callers. How can I help you other than bringing it to people's awareness?
Well, right now I've totally had it up to here, and I'm probably on the verge of mentally cracking.
I'm sorry.
But, before I do that, I would like to throw it out there that I'd like to start a movement for fresh air in the Wailua area and the whole island of Kauai. My name is Dustin J. McDonald. My phone number is 346-1039. Anybody interested in joining forces with me to gain fresh air back in their house and battle anybody that has a chimney that's disrupting their health, please give me a call because I'm tapped out of resources and I don't know what else to do.
It's becoming
a very dire need.
You said you've spoken to the county council people. You've tried to do a resolution. Have you worked on that?
We can't get anything out of them. It's ironic that they can give you the power to stop your neighbor's dog from barking, but you can't stop your neighbor from killing you with their smoke.
That is ironic, and I was making the parallel in my own mind. Have you tried even beginning with an online petition? Because sometimes,
Right now, first I'm going to circle my neighborhood just to get the immediate people that are affected by this chimney, because I've been talking to a couple neighbors, and they smell it too. But they haven't been through the hell and back that I've been through with my kids, because I know what it can do to you in a long-term exposure. It slowly chisels away at your health.
That's right.
You might think it's no big deal at first, but check back with me 2 years later when you're finally, every morning, your whole family sounds like Alice Cooper. You know, it's not fair and it's not right that somebody has the right to torture you and you don't have any legal boundaries. There's nothing I can do. I was told by Monica Atrask himself that the only thing I can do is take it matters in my own hands and protect my family myself. That's what I was told out of his mouth.
And you sound very, very much the same as the people who live directly downwind in the dust fields.
It's the same thing. There's someone is creating a substance that is injuring my family. And it's becoming into my property, into my private area, and into my intimate body.
Yes. So, what is your name again?
I
have your number.
There's nothing.
What's your name again?
Dustin J. MacDonald.
Dustin.
My number is 346-1039, and I'm willing to do anything that is in the right to make this go away, because they're trying to tell me that chimneys are grandfathered in. Well, you know what? Grandfathers die, and stuff, ideas like that, those have to go away, because we can't go on living, beating our head against a brick wall just because some stupid thing is written down and grandfathered in. That's not right.
Okay, so thank you so much for calling.
Okay, 346-1039. Please, anybody that has anything that can help me or you have any ideas, I'm open for anything, because we need fresh air. It's
okay, Dustin.
A fireplace is an amenity.
Thank you.
All right, thank you so much.
Aloha. Okay, we'll take one quick call, and then we're going to get to you, Skeeter. Thank you for being in here. You are on the air.
Hey, how's it, Felicia?
Good.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Okay. Well, I just wanted to point out, I was listening to the Hawaiian brother before, this guy, right? And he's talking about, can I go back to Hawaiian laws? So what Hawaiian laws he talking about? Like, if you go on birthmark, they show you in the emu as a child. Or if you do something wrong, they smash your head in with the rock. I don't think that they even know what he's talking about, bro. There's no way of going back to the time that he's thinking about. And I get my roots deep in Hawaii. And I get relatives that is Hawaiian Portuguese, and they're a sovereign movement. I support all of them. But even the smart guys recognize there's no reverting back to old Hawaii law. He's not.
But we can move forward.
And second of all, I just want to rant and rave, like all these knuckleheads on your radio ranting and raving ridiculous stuff. Second of all, the guy with the chimney problem, move back to wherever you came. Because guys like you is what we don't like. We don't like your ideas about your personal body and the air. Brother, you should have lived here when we had the sugar cane. Or go move Maui where they get the sugar cane still. So my point to him is, whatever, move your house, sell your house. You have the right. Like the guy has the right to have that chimney because you point out it's an amenity. If you have a house that's lavish and whatever, then that's an amenity too. And we're like, you don't move to it. But we can find one ridiculous argument to point on somebody else all day long. I can come here and sit here and tell you all day long of how your dog attacked mine, and because mine kills yours, you call in a cop. That's not how we did it 30 years ago. Okay, grandfather that in, buddy. Hey, you don't like the chimney, move. I hate saying that, but you guys forcing me for saying that yourself.
Okay, thank you for sharing.
Okay,
okay,
bye.
Aloha. Skeeter.
Hi, Felicia.
Let's see if I can mic you up just a little better. Can you speak right into the microphone?
Okay, here I am, Felicia, ready to talk.
Okay, thank you. Skeeter. Polarski, and I see Ricky is on the air listening. A lot of different people besides San Leandro, Garden Grove, San Diego, people kind of from all over the place are listening in. Tokyo, you're talking to a number of people in the world right now. Grants Pass, Oregon, I don't know if any of those are your people. Permaculture, you've done permaculture in many, many different places, and thank you that you just finished up a great program here, over 2 weeks. I was there for the project demonstrations, and I'm really excited about them happening. What thoughts do you have for us as what you've learned in this time here, this trip?
Well, this is my sixth trip to Kauai, and every time I'm a serious student, and I run around learning as much as I can. And I guess no matter who's listening in the world, the take-home message that I come away with here in Kauai is valid everywhere. How do people produce their own food in their own places, produce their own energy, and live lightly, lighter on the earth so there's more space for everybody else? How do we live a life that doesn't have those toxic things in the air? And I sympathize with the guy with the smoke, and I use wood smoke myself. I live in Montana. It's darn cold there. And it makes me think, how do we live our life so it impacts other people less harmfully? When we consume a lot of stuff from far away, We're generally hurting somebody somewhere else. We don't know who we're exploiting. And so the closer you can make things, buy things, produce things, the less chance at, you know, somebody's suffering somewhere else from it. And so that's what permaculture can teach us. That's where our holy grail is living life happily, comfortably, on local resources, about, let's say, not 80, 90% local resources, so we don't have to drag stuff from everywhere else, like so much of the world does.
I saw the presentations, and I was really excited about some of them. And because I live in Kilauea, it's extra easy to be excited about. Looked like we were looking at 97 acres worth of land to be repurposed in you know, healthy organic agriculture. Maybe not all of it has to be organic, a little bit of conventional, but definitely food for the people on their own terms. And that was pretty exciting.
Yeah, I was excited to be part of the Kilauea Ag Park. You know, it's been in the works for a long time.
About three decades.
Harry here and other, you know, other callers here, that's how do we get more people on the land? How do we get... And I said, I would say that of the 60,000 of good quality ag land on Kauai, probably half of it's not in production at this time, or at least very minimal. How do we get more people making that land productive? And I would say let the Hawaiians be first in line. Locals be first in line. And there's so much land out there, actually, that there probably ain't enough Hawaiians that... or locals in line that even want to do it, you know. Let them all have a space. You know, there's plenty of land to go around for those that want to actually do something with it. So, because let's face it, most people don't want to get their hands that dirty. So if someone does, well, let's give them a chance.
I'll have to show you Harry's place. In the land where you live right there, the soil's been a bit depleted from pineapple. Is that what has...
Yes, it has. It's the old pineapple lands from the old days.
There's a lot of ways to bioremediate that and to add soil to it. I know that you have wanted to do a little bit of yardening at your place.
I would say scrape up the top 2 feet and then start from there.
Because of the toxins in it?
Oh, yeah. Sure, there is a lot of toxins in it. The plastic bag's still there.
Mm.
You know, all those plastic you use in the pineapple fields, still there.
Well, I know we were looking on the west side at different places where there's quite a bit of toxicity, so we've been having deep discussions on how to remediate that.
Yeah, one of the things that we're looking at here is bioremediation and mycoremediation, or remediation using fungi, mushrooms. And there's a lot of experience in the world with that. And we want to bring that experience here to Kauai and clean it up, because who could be against cleaning up the poisons that are laying around? There's too much of them. They're not good for the kids. Nobody, it's not a good thing. Everybody wants to clean it up. So I called I sent a message to my friend Paul Stamets, who's one of the top fungi mycoremediation guys in the world, and said, hey, Paul, would you like a paid, trip to Kauai and help us out. So wondering or hopeful that he might say yes, and we get him here and get some experts here. So one of the things I see is that we are identifying, we know some of the solutions to the problems here in Kauai. We don't know all of them, but we know a lot. And let's get the people, the best experts in the world, to come here and show us how to solve those, you know, those remaining problems. And then once the local people are trained, they can go and help people other places. So we will have people coming here to learn and people from here going to teach in the long run.
For those who aren't familiar, can you explain how you safely bioremediate depleted or toxic soils?
Well, there's a number of steps. One of them is getting a lot of organic matter in there, and the other is getting a lot of biology happening. So a lot of times we'll do inoculation with special bacteria, strains of bacteria, fungi. There's various soil organisms that actually eat some of that bad stuff. They can eat arsenic and lead, But they can really usually break up the hydrocarbons. A lot of the pesticides can be broken up. A lot of the oil compounds are relatively easy, actually. Petroleum products are easier than some of the stuff. But basically, it's a biological process. The more the biology and the more finely tuned the biology is. So we have to feed the biology. They'll eat everything. They'll eat up more and more and more of it. So it might take for some things 2, 5, 10 years to clean up. And then there's some things that are going to be long term. You might pull out some of them with
plants
that accumulate, you know, like there are plants that accumulate heavy metals, for instance. Use those, pull it up, take those guys out. You ship the ashes off to the smelter, you know. I don't think you have that many heavy metals here, is my guess.
It's mostly arsenic and lead.
What? Explain what the heavy metals are.
Okay, arsenic, lead, cadmium are generally the ones most concerned with. And so, actually, I should say, I don't know what the situation here is. I come from a place, the apple orchards of Washington, where we had many years of arsenic lead applied as a orchard spray. So I'm very familiar with lead arsenic soils and how do you work with that.
Yeah, I think it would be, you've come several different times, and I think it would be fun to put another big symposium on and invite a lot of people and possibly very much the people who are in the business of utilizing these contaminants, because even if they take their boundary areas, their buffer zones, and they could be putting something in there that is actually breaking it down and remediating it. I know, you know, us purists, we don't ever want them to be using that stuff, but if you're living right downwind of them, still yet, if those things get neutralized before it runs down further stream, that's a big step in the right direction. So it might be that we can be working with them working with anybody trying to break down these pieces.
We're going to be in a transition period. People around the world are saying, no, we really don't want poison in our food. And so I'm assuming that that will be coming more home here on Kauai. It's certainly looking that way. So there'll be less use of this stuff. There'll be bigger buffer zones. Better buffer zones. Probably will be illegal to have contaminate groundwater, fresh water with pesticides. So it's going to get harder and harder to use them. And so we have methods for how to control the pests without using this bad stuff and how to do agriculture without the herbicide. So we have a better way of doing it.
And you are listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, K284 Haole Iwa. This is Kauai Soapbox Live. I'm Felicia. Harry and Larry are helping me with the show, and our guest is Skeeter Pilarski, permaculturist.
And it seems as if when you're talking about accumulating and trying to concentrate the heavy metals, there are places where those, if you could take them away and you could purify them and concentrate them, where the heavy metals would be used in a positive way.
Oh, yeah, bring them back into the system, into the loop. Yeah.
So rather than to get them out of the food supply, the food chain, the water supply, you can take them because there's a lot of industrial applications for the heavy metals. They're part of the periodic chart of elements there are huge mining projects to get those heavy metals. If you could concentrate it, that would create a secondary industry where you can take it, purify it, concentrate it, and use it for recycle it in ways that aren't detrimental to human utilization.
Yeah, it's pretty diffuse out there. Getting the soil really healthy is a basic thing we got to do, and we do that with lots of organic matter and lots of cover crops and for more perennial crops. And there's on and on and on. I wish I could give every leap reader a 2-week permaculture design course.
Mm-hmm.
But can't do that here. But I guess some things I wanted to point out is that we could produce, you know, here's a list of some of the things we want to do. We want to produce the agricultural fuel on the island, on-island fertilizers as much as possible. We're looking at that. Soil inoculants to make the soil healthier. Our whole range of fruit and nut species, what kind of species for those oil crops or fuel crops. Reorienting tourism to more agritourism, ecotourism, and actually restoration tourism. There's a lot of people that I think that would want to come here and make the Aina better. And so we get people here that are leaving more behind than just money and a few jobs, but that they're contributing. How can we produce more of our own livestock feed? What's the right scale for dairies? Much smaller scale. Again, local feed for more livestock. How do we do it locally? Most livestock feed's imported right now. What's the timber species? How can the beekeeping? What's our local seed industry going to be? There's so many things we can do, and again, it comes back to what Harry and other people have been saying here. We got to get more people on the land. We got to anybody that wants to farm. We should. There's enough land out there, and there's a lot of opportunity. Let's make it easy for anybody that wants to farm to actually start doing it. I guess that's my bottom line.
Yeah, and KCC is the college has got a lot of programs too. There's a number of them, and it's spreading. You went to one of the meetings when you first got here, correct?
Yes, there's a Go Farm program at KCC training new farmers right now. 14 farmers are taking, I believe, a 200-hour course over the next while. So they're, yeah, but 14's a, you know, it's 14 more people. We just had 24 people graduate from our permaculture course. There's 38. How many of them actually might want to actually start farming? You know, maybe half of them. If we could crank out that many every year, that's still too small. I'd like to see, how about we get 100 new farmers or something like that every year for the next number of years and start beefing it up.
I see KCCC has their own, they actually grow a lot of plants there, don't they? Do you know much about that at all?
Well, yeah, they have their own gardens over there.
KCCC is Kauai Community Correctional Center. But, I mean, it seems like they grow some pretty good plants. I know.
Well, I see a lot of collo growing.
I see a lot of collo growing. I mean, I wonder if people... next week, I have three guests that have just very recently left Kauai Community Correctional Center. And so we're going to be talking about what goes on in there and after there and before there. Because food is really part of the whole scheme of pretty much everything. That's one of the most basic building blocks of how our society is structured. And really needing to go to the store and buy your food, if you follow that pathway back, it actually creates that difficult need to go out and earn money to have food. Like, 100 years ago, even 70, 80 years ago, a lot of the people that we make poi with, they remember a time when they just grew all their own food, and there was a lot less need for money, and so that's a big challenge that we have created for ourselves here in the recent history. Skeeter, in other places in the country, do you see comparisons? Do you see something similar? Something different?
Yeah, I think what's happening here on Kauai is... happening all around the U.S. localization, a less chemical farming, people wanting more control over their own lives. You know, the same urges are happening all around the country. People like freedom, and people like, I guess it's localization in food, localization of decision making. Yeah, there's just more desire for localization, which I think is necessary.
And you're from Montana, and so it's very cold there. How easy is it to be self-sufficient for food in a cold place?
Oh, I'm can do pretty good myself. It's actually not that difficult. I actually think that being locally supported agriculture is probably one of our. It takes work, but it's not rocket science. you know, running our, getting our own fuel systems is maybe a little more tricky, for instance. So in Montana, we have big root cellars, and we put a lot of food up, and we have things last a long time. Here, it's a lot harder to preserve food or keep, you know, you have to, it's more like you need food fresh coming off all the time. So it's a little bit different. We go in a wave, we store, then we use in the winter, then we grow it again. Here, it's just sort of like it's always should be coming off. You don't have to go to the store. You don't need as much refrigeration. You don't need the root cellars. Do lots of canning and drying. It's nice having that fresh food. I think that in general, I would always, I'm an herbal grower and wildcrafter. I ship, hundreds, thousands of pounds of herbs every year to a lot of medicine makers. And in our industry, it's pretty recognized that fresh is going to give you better results than dried or processed. I would say the same about food. The more fresh food you can eat, closer to the source, better for your diet. You know, it's more traditional diet here. It's amazing that Kauai used to have 18,000 acres of lowies, they figure, and that it used to support this population much bigger than today. It was 100% local food. Even until 1960s, most of Kauai produced its own food. All the way up to 1960, it's a recent phenomenon that we're doing all this food exporting. It isn't like, oh, we're stuck here. It's like, no. We're not stuck here. Let's go change it.
What you're talking about is fascinating. If you pique the interest in someone, but they're not intending to be a farmer, or they want to get a cursory knowledge or build on the knowledge of what they have, how would you suggest they gain wisdom in what you're speaking about?
Well, you can read books. You can go to the YouTube. My God, you could spend the rest of your life on YouTube looking at agriculture and urban and home garden systems. Master Gardeners has a program.
Regenerations. Come and help at Regenerations on Wednesdays and Saturdays. Saturdays is a particularly good day, and that works well for the casual person who just wants to learn some. They don't have to pay for it. They don't have to make a commitment. They can kind of come and participate and help and get a lot of exposure on how to do it. And the best place to come for that is at Kalihiwai Ridge at our food forest and garden up there, which is about maybe a half a mile up and on the left. So people could look at RIBG for Regenerations International Botanical Garden.org. We're pretty...
on the Malka side.
Yes, on the mountain side of the road. Yes, Malka, for sure. Yeah, so I think we're ambitious with our eye in there, international, but kind of international because we can bring plants in and out amongst other countries.
I'd just like to point out that permaculture isn't just about small farms. When you talk about local food production, right in the backyard and right around the corner and right in the community is a big part of it. And, you know, here Felicia's Akamai backyard actually is an internationally famous example of how you can produce a lot of stuff in a backyard. So, you know, Felicia's really showed that a lot can be done. And I'm impressed, I must say, by Kauai. There's a lot more food grown here in people's yards. And yards are much more beautiful here than they are on the mainland in general. And I just did a round the United States train trip, and I looked out the train window all day long, and I counted gardens. And I must say that the Southeast United States was particularly pitiful.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. There was hardly any gardens. I mean, I could go hundreds of miles and not see a single garden. I could see... coming into Washington, D.C., I went for, you know, a couple hundred miles and finally saw three orchards, none of them in good shape. And there's not much, people don't put much energy into the yards. They might have a lawnmower and a grass. There's a lot of junk around there. There's a lot of America's going downhill fast out there, folks. And so Kauai is really a breath of fresh air.
You just struck on something interesting. We need some permacultural people in Washington, D.C., so our government officials would know how to do this and encourage it.
Oh, amen. Wouldn't that be nice? I've never been anywhere that couldn't use permaculture. There's nowhere that's a Shangri-La yet. Kauai could become a Shangri-La quicker than a lot of places. There are some places. I have a friend that just spent some time living on Tonga in a sort of remote island, and they said it's all local economy. They're growing all their own food. They're doing their own thing. They interface very little with modern society, and it's people are pretty happy, and it's there are some Shangri-La places, and they aren't where it's most modern. The most Shangri-La places are where it's least modern.
Well, I think that with my experience, which came in a short time after I took your last permaculture course that was here, it was less than a year when I had so much food available. And so my theory is if I can do it, anybody can do it. And most people who see me, they size that one up and say, yeah, probably. You know, I don't have anything that I would say most people wouldn't have at least as much of, if not more. I do have a home, though. That is a starting point. In Anahola, you grew up in Washington State, yeah?
Oh yeah.
And
for
so what?
30
did,
years.
And what did you? What part of Washington State were you in?
The southwest part of Washington, right off the Columbia River.
What was the name of the
town?
Station.
Longview, Washington. How's it, Longview?
Trying to see if we got any Longview people in here. We got a lot of people from
different
places.
Hey, I've been through Longview. I know that. It's one of the big industrial timber capitals of Washington State.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, big industry there.
Big industry.
Because I've just been in Portland a bit, and they seem to be very garden-friendly there. I can't believe how beautiful everybody's yards are. Just stunning.
Green.
And beautiful.
Yep.
I think, where do they have this kind of time? And there's a lot of plants and orchards everywhere there in Oregon. Is Oregon typical in other places? Skeeter, you said you just did around the country.
Oregon stacked up well around as compared to the rest of the United States. I'd say Oregon was one of the best places. And I was also particularly impressed with Minnesota, northern Minnesota. A lot of good soils, a lot of natural resources, good capital. So it's one of the things that every part of the world needs is natural resources, and where the land's healthy and there's good water, and clean. There's a lot of places that aren't anymore, and not overcrowded. I mean, look at the population density in Bangladesh or Burundi sometime, and Kauai will look pretty darn good in comparison.
And you're going to a North American permaculture convergence, is that correct, next month?
That's in August. And so the permaculture movement has about 300,000 graduates now that have gone through the regular program. And, there's millions of others that are, using it in some form or another. So we're a little movement, and we're a young movement, but we have a lot to offer. And so certainly any listeners out there, I'd recommend you Google up and YouTube up permaculture, and you'll find lots of really interesting stuff to look at. We were just looking at a documentary called Green Gold.
And that was on YouTube.
Yes, yeah, on YouTube, Green Gold. A Chinese gentleman put it together. I can't think of his name. Henry Liu or something.
John Liu. He sounded American to me.
Yeah, right. He's Chinese descent, but
yeah.
American. But he looks at international look at the situation and how permaculture can help, how we can turn the system around. And he says, look, we can fix it. We can fix things. And I'm optimistic. We can fix things. And Kauai is in a good position. It just needs to play some cards a little better, and people got to pay more attention. Everybody should go out and vote. Everybody should be paying attention. It's not a good time to sleepwalk. There's danger afoot, so pay attention.
Can you elaborate on that? Pay attention to what? What are your concerns?
Someone said the other day, it's pretty easy to see tyranny coming down the line. So I guess that's one thing I'd pay attention to is the political establishment and the at the higher levels, the gigantism, the bigism, the centralization of power has really gone too far. And the collusion between big corporations and big government is just so obvious these days. The revolving door between, for instance, Monsanto and the Department of Agriculture, for instance, and even in the Supreme Court, and in many other regulatory agencies. The regulatory agencies have been captured, they call it, by the corporations that they're supposed to regulate with the revolving door thing. And that can't lead to any good results. And so that's why people need to pay attention, they need to vote, and they need to the goal is to do something to create your own abundance, your own production at the home level, and two, to help influence the civic affairs of your neighborhood, your county, your state, we're currently under the United States federal rules here too. And so the gentleman wanting to see more Hawaiian sovereignty is calling for local control by, you know, his people. And, the federal government ain't going to surrender easily, let's say that. So, anyway, so I guess that's a few words along those lines.
Well, were you saying something, Harry?
Well, just the fact that us living here in Hawaii, the government, I don't know. It's kind of been hard for the local people, but I think it's time to move on past that point. And like you said, I think we got to use more diversity in our lands, grow more food.
Yeah, and
feed more people.
I think we had a caller who called in that was talking about some of the harsh realities of pre-contact Hawaii, but I believe almost everybody is looking at moving forward, not moving back. Like, independence does not mean having the same political structure that had existed. It's like you have to work with the now, and how do we work towards localized control at as many levels as possible. And so when you look at individual sovereignty, where you're growing your own food or you're heating your own water or whatever you can do, that's something that we need too. Many, many people have become dependent on the system, over-dependent on the system. And so the system starts to exhaust if they have to feed and medicate and house and, you know, keep everybody warm, whatever it takes. You know, the more we do for ourselves, the stronger everything else becomes, too.
Any system gets depleted if there's a reliance outside. You have to be, at some point, be self-reliant, and you have to take a responsibility for self-reliance. And when you go outside to seek someone to take care of you, there's a price you pay for that, and I think that's one of the problems. I think if you get a little bit, I may not be choosing the right word, but if you get a little bit lazy and say, "Please take care of me," I don't want to take responsibility to take care of things, I think you pay a price for that.
Yeah, and certainly you need to self-educate. You need to become responsible for your own education. That's one very big area, you know, as well as food, as so many different pieces in your own life. We can't have everybody riding in the wagon. Somebody's got to be pulling it.
This is just a personal thing. You had alluded to it earlier in the show. My mom left Germany at age 13 in the middle of the night. Most of her relatives didn't make it out of there. And the reason is she was born in the wrong neighborhood, born in the wrong culture. And growing up in that household, my mother wasn't bitter about it. She didn't say, "You got to get something from someone." She didn't talk much about it, but she would say, "Don't make yourself dependent upon the government or the corporations. Make sure that you're always in a position where you can take care of yourself." And that was about it. But those little few words were tremendous wisdom from a quiet woman. And I think as I get older, she was had a tremendous amount of wisdom. And I think when Skeeter's talking about be careful, there's collusion between corporations and the government, the story that they keep repeating is they're feeding the world. It's necessary. So why would you be careful of that? And I go back to what my mom would say, when you become dependent on someone else to take care of you, then you run the risk of the conditions they set or the conditions you live with, whether it's good for you or bad for you.
And in the earlier half of this show, we were talking a little bit about false history and false realities. And so when big pieces are omitted from our history, like maybe what happened 6,000 years ago was a reemergence of civilization, not the first emergence of civilization. So there's many, many elements like that. And so we are, get conditioned to believe what we're told. And we need to really learn to investigate everything and be responsible for our own understandings and not be addicted to convenience. I think that is where we're the most vulnerable. Nobody wants to be inconvenienced.
Freedom of choice is a tremendous asset to have. It's a tremendous virtue to have, where you have the freedom to make your own decisions and your and to dictate your path. If you could be free to choose your path, that's a tremendous thing to give to my children and future grandchildren. And I think we should do that. Whenever we've become dependent on some corporation will take care of us, some government will take care of it, it doesn't seem to work out so well. And when I'm hearing you speak about permaculture, or Harry, you talk about your experience in Anahola, when you lose that freedom of choice, that's a problem. Autonomy is a good thing.
Autonomy is good.
And Pete's Jazz Lounge is coming up soon. We'll have a few final words, and we'll hear the county council report for this week. And that's one to talk about paying attention. That's a good thing to pay attention to. And to go in there, and you really help our council members by going and attending. Something I have learned in the past couple of years is how dependent our policymakers are on us to point out for them some of the weaker points in issues that come up, laws, legislations, very typically ordinances, legislation, rules that come up are largely penned by industry or individuals. And they have so many that they've got to look at. They really do depend, I think, at an unhealthy level on people protesting to hear the counter argument. And when we have a 90 work day legislative season and we throw 3,000 bills at them, that's asking them to do an awful lot. And our county council works really, really hard, and they really need us to pay attention and help them make the right decisions.
Well, knowledge and wisdom is a good tool to have, and when you pass that many bills in such a short time, you can't be knowledgeable or have the wisdom to make the right choices. And look at the trouble that we're having in terms of paying attention and being diligent and watching what's going on. We're trying to get legislation passed to gain wisdom and knowledge and information. And that's something that should never be taken away from people. The right to gain knowledge is something that seems to be so self-evident. I don't get why we have to fight for it.
And Skeeter, do you have a final thought for Kauai?
Repair the ecosystems. Replant, get more forest going, stop the erosion, clean up the water. You can have, you're down to 1/4 of your fishery potential now. Make the waters run clear, have more rain-fed agriculture so you don't have to take so much water out of the streams. Improve the systems. Kauai could be maybe 50% richer than it is in natural resources right now, and that'd be a good job for Kauai. Go for it.
And Harry, what's your thoughts? Thank you so much for coming in, by the way.
You bet.
Being here, first time, it's okay.
Yeah.
Nice meeting these people here.
Yeah, and we hope you come in some more.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you for listening to Kauai Soapbox Live. This is Felicia with Harry and Larry, and Michael Pilarski, also known as Skeeter. So we're going to hear the county council report, and then we're going to hear Pete's Live Jazz.